accession number 18822, reel 18.
Reel 18.
Yep. There was nothing we could do for him. We'd had to put him in the boot of a car to get him to the railway station with a chance of getting to safety, and he blew it, so we just left him to his own devices. I never found out what happened to him. He may have been beaten to death by Muslims, for all I know. Before the coup, but after self-government, we were inundated with experts, and eventually we would say cynically, an expert is a failed American academic who's travelled 3,000 miles in a straight line. And we needed, in Bornu province, an expert on cattle, because we wanted, there was a desperate need in the towns for protein, and if we could make it viable to have the cattle move on the hoof towards the big towns and have abattoirs put up and the meat sold, that would be a good thing for a start. The Fulani cattle owner would have a reasonable price for some of his cattle, and if he didn't, they were beginning to overgraze. There were more cattle than there was some pasture or fodder. So we needed to cull the cattle, to sell the meat to the towns desperately needing meat and protein, and we wanted somebody to organise it. Alternative was to slaughter them in northern Nigeria and send it all by refrigerated trains to where the meat was needed. And we needed a kind of first-class vet who was clued up about either using trains or coping with the problems of refrigerated meat or organising water and fodder every 15 miles if it was decided to push them down on the hoof. And we were told, we've got an American expert coming to you, and his salary was slightly more than the regional governor's salary. And we thought, well, he must be good. But when he arrived, he was useless, worse than useless. He was an academic who knew only one thing, and that was how to deal with a particular form of trypanosomiasis which occurs only in Mexico. He knew nothing else. And so the bureaucracy with United Nations, USAID, Ford Foundation, and so on was so awful, we were getting absolutely hopeless people sent the whole time. And I remember one meeting where Alhaji Ali Akilu, the senior northerner who'd taken over the premier's office, eyeball to eyeball, said to a group of self-satisfied Americans that 80% of the men they sent out and the work they did was absolutely useless. And though it cost Nigeria nothing in the way of transport costs to get him to Nigeria or his salary and allowances while he was in Nigeria, he still used a bungalow and some office space, and he wasn't even worth that. But it was very, very difficult. Anybody who could have handled the Bornu cattle scheme would almost certainly get paid more in a commercial firm or United Nations in a richer area. And then there was, when Uganda got independence, the expatriates had one terrific party where they dressed up as porters. We were not allowed to call them coolies. And each one of them was given what looked like a 56-pound load on one of those bits of cloth that they put on their heads, and they came in to this party, which was everything, a drinks party, a dance, the whole lot all together, sing-song, everything, and they solemnly laid down these loads and saying, "We are laying down the white man's burden." And everybody thought this was a very funny party. Terrific, very amusing.
This was when Nigeria got independent.
No, this was Uganda. Uganda. About before, after Nigerian independence, but before the military coup. And the Ugandans were furious. And they tried to take disciplinary action against all those who'd taken part or even attended the... reduce their pensions or something. The extraordinary thing is that if the same thing had happened in northern Nigeria, the most we would have got out of the Nigerians would be a loud laugh. I mean, they would have thought it's screamingly funny. So it just depended. And there was the a friend of mine in somewhere in Lancashire used Liverpool for supplying Nigeria with educational equipment, anything from school exercise books, textbooks, pencils, stationery. And this, he worked, he did, quite an efficient chap. The stuff went out on what was one of the Elgemster cargo boats to Liverpool, from Liverpool, reached Lagos, and was sold and reused. We were spending quite a lot of development money on opening primary schools, and there were, even the Igbos and Yorubas had a reasonable number of secondary schools, and so there was a big market for this kind of stuff. But after independence, he received a letter saying that he would not be allowed to take out of Nigeria one penny's worth of any profits he made from this firm, still less the cost of the machinery and educational equipment and materials he was selling. So he got he spent a couple of £100 getting aboard a plane at Heathrow, flew to Lagos, drove into Lagos and asked for a room at the Bristol Hotel, because you had to have a firm base with running water, drinks, snacks, and a bedroom. There's no point in trying to get anything done in Lagos if you hadn't got that. And they said smoothly, "There's a £50 deposit before you can get a room." So he handed them over £50 in English money. And then he went the rounds. He went to the Ministry of Finance and the section dealing with exchange control and the Education Ministry. And after some time, maybe a day or two, it dawned on him that nothing, the Nigerians were not going to play. He was never going to get a penny back of his capital, still less any profits he made. Well, he always said cheerfully, "We have a holiday hotel on Victoria Beach. Why don't you spend it all by staying there?" And so when he realised that was it, he cut his losses, asked for a bill, paid £25 for the room he'd had, got £25 change in Nigerian money, he'd rung up the airport and fixed himself a passage, and he went out to the airport, and as he was passing through customs, a customs official, alerted by a hotel receptionist, accused him of attempting to leave Nigeria with 25 Nigerian pounds in his pocket illegally. And this is a bit of a facer, and he didn't quite know how to handle it, but the customs official said smoothly, "If you leave the £25 on that desk there, you'll hear no more about it." So he got back to England about £250 the poorer, with absolutely nothing achieved. So up till the coup, I had never, ever felt the slightest feeling of personal lack of safety, even when I was relaying an unpleasant instruction that local people were not going to like. British prestige and 50 years of rule begun by Lord Lugard had left its mark. In fact, we used to, while I was briefly in Lagos, we spent Sunday mornings on the rifle range having rifle shooting competition, and we would ask the army storekeeper for 500 rounds of ammunition, and he'd say, "Certainly, sir, would you care for any ground sheets if you're going to fire in the prone position?" Things were so safe that to my little sub-district or district or whatever, every now and again they would send a cash tank about the size of that with £1,000 in it in notes and change for use for paying local wages and various things. And all they would ever have in charge of this £1,000 would be a treasury official who had the key round his neck and one police constable. And it was completely safe. We never had any case of anybody trying to steal these cash tanks. The easiest thing in the world to bash the treasury official on the head, bash the police constable on the head, grab the key from round the neck of the treasury official, opened up, helped himself to £1,000, a lot of money to Nigerian. This was all before 1966, when it was worth easily 20, 25 times what it is today. But it never happened. So there was a complete sense of stability, security, and safety until the revolution emerged. After that, it all broke. My friend never got his money back, so it went on. And my own messengers speculated on the chance of going out, beating up myself, my wife, and vandalizing and pinching all our things. There was complete and absolute change, dated not from self-government, but 6 years later, January 1966, the revolutionary military coup. Then I tried to resign. I didn't like the way they had beaten up my Igbo servant. Some desperate Igbo employees from my ministry, the ministry I was working in, came surreptitiously and said they were desperate. They were sleeping out in the open, but they were being hunted down and beaten up and killed with matchets. And they had survived so far, what could I do? And I said, I can't do a damn thing. The situation is out of control. So I went round and handed my resignation in to SecPrem's office. And they said, you do realise you have contravened Nigeria Revolutionary Military Government Edict number 34. I said, good God, what's that? And they said, you have indicated that the situation is not fully under control, and that is a criminal offence. I thought, crumbs, if I'm wheeled up before a Nigerian magistrate, even if he gives me something like 7 days or a fine, I might lose the whole of my pension, because the terms were that from the sending of my resignation, I must serve 12 full months. And it was that I objected to, and that made them say, right, you have contradicted contravened Edict 34. And I had to grovel. I had a wife and two small children. Things were getting worse and worse. The train that normally brought up milk, butter, cold store generally, in a refrigerated compartment every day, never came again. We had to do without. We had to change our diet. I managed to get hold of a large tin of Klim, powdered milk, and we managed on that. And I managed to buy some eggs, get my steward to buy some eggs in the marketplace. Generally speaking, things were getting rough, breaking down, and getting it a bit rough. So I rushed round to the UK Deputy High Commissioner and said, things are impossible. I said, you know, I have my ministry servants, no more food and supplies coming up from Lagos, small children lacking milk and butter and what have you. And when I tried to resign, they accused me of contravening Edict 34. What can you do to help? And the UK Deputy High Commissioner said, absolutely nothing. You've been here 19 years. You speak the language. You ought to know what's going on. Of your own volition, 6 years ago, you elected to stay on in northern Nigeria with your leaving your accrued pension here until you finally retired, when it would be transferred to UK. And I can't stand this place. I can't speak a word of the language. I thought I was going to be posted to Canberra, Quebec, or Copenhagen, and I was sent to Kaduna. I don't know what I did wrong to justify that. Nigeria has been independent for 6 years, and if you elected to serve that country after independence, anything that goes wrong is entirely up to you. I can't help you. So I said, well, if you can't help me, why are you sitting in this grandiose consular or embassy or high commission building in some comfort, with five air conditioners whirring away at the British taxpayers' expense, and you've got no powers to do anything effective? And he looked at me as though I'd said a dirty word in a drawing room. He rang a bell, and a servant dressed in a starched, long white kaftan-like servant's garment with a green cummerbund came in, and I was shown out. And that was all the help I ever got from the UK Deputy High Commissioner. And so I sweated and grovelled and served 12 months, and we finally got away. And that was pretty grim. Almost everything had broken down. You couldn't reach, let's see, the Nigeria Biafra Civil War had broken out. Things had escalated from the coup, the massacre of Igbo adult males, breakdown of law and order, and general breakdown of the infrastructure, suppliers, and so on. And everywhere there were Nigerian troops with 3 weeks training, armed with a rifle, who could stop your car and demand to see the boot, which really meant, I'll accuse you of trying to take something illegal in the boot of your car unless you slip me 10 shillings or something like that. There were still these troops preventing anybody from driving down to Lagos by car. The roads were blocked. as I said, a section of 10 men, or I think they had a platoon of 30 men with 3 light machine guns and 27 rifles, and you certainly wouldn't get past them. And the railway station was blocked. And the only way, having served out my 12 months, to get back to England was to reach Lagos before the last mail boat left Lagos. There were no more mail boats after that time. Now, by then, it was August 1967. And to do it, I had to fly Angela and both children to Kano, and bribing a Nigerian army NCO at the airport. And then at Kano, I managed to get another flight for all four of us, very difficult, down to Lagos. Then I had to get 9 miles from Lagos Airport into central Lagos, and then I had to get aboard the mail boat, which was at Apapa on the other side of the harbour and a mile or two away. And all this was terribly difficult with armed soldiers wandering around, and once I was in a taxi with some other chaps in my position. We were trying to go somewhere to get something done, and some civilians rushed up and started to shake the taxi, and I realised what they wanted us was to empty our pockets and give them whatever money we had, otherwise they'd turn the taxi over and we would end up injured and easy prey for them to pinch something. Nobody came to help us, but we managed somehow to get out of that mess. And we, the mail boat was difficult because a Belgian plane, please, bringing in equipment needed by the Nigerian army, there was a panic in a Nigerian army machine gun post, and they fired at the plane. But the plane was so low, all they hit was the mail boat, cabin C-67, and that cabin had to be closed off while there were inquiries and whatever. So there was chaos everywhere, gangs rocking your vehicles if you were trying to get from A to B in a car, railway stations and roads blocked by armed troops. United Kingdom Deputy High Commissioners were the reverse of helpful, and short of which, of all the things that we normally expected to be brought up daily from the coast. But with enormous difficulty, I finally got out to the docks with the whole family, and for a very small bribe, it would have cost me a fortune later on, I had everything I owned, all my personal effects, completely intact, on the docks waiting to be loaded. I'd given a bribe to somebody competent. And so it all went aboard, and I lost nothing. And we got the family aboard. It wasn't a very good cabin, but the place was absolutely packed. There were 267 berths, and every single one was taken. And one of the odd things was, after a while, you could tell at a glance who had, by chance, bought a house in England before the coup, and who hadn't. A lot of people said, "I'm not going to buy a house in England because when I finally do leave Nigeria, taking with me my redundancy pay and my accrued pension, I don't know where I'll be able to get a job, so I won't buy a house until I've got a job." But they were the ones who lost out, because they had to, they were reaching England in the autumn of 67, when house prices were rising, and they had absolutely nowhere to stay. And if they were going to spend, well, most of us spend, I spent 4 months before I got a job. And then after getting a job, you would have to find a schoolhouse. You could be 6 months or more with your savings dribbling away in a hotel at enormous expense. So you from the body language and what people said aboard the boat, you could tell who'd got a house. Well, by the grace of God, we'd bought a house at Wheatley, 6 miles out from here. I'm not quite sure why, but at least we'd done it. Just for once, I'd done the right thing. And I might mention one of the reasons for the coup, although we thought the handover to Nigerian self-government was the perfect handover, in fact, on a population basis, 51% of the seats in the regional House of Representatives were northern Muslims, and 49% were Yorubas and Igbos, and the northerners were using that little majority. There is no tyranny more complete than a British committee or parliamentary body with a slight but permanent majority. And this drove the Igbos and Yorubas mad, as decision after decision favoured the northerners and didn't favour them. And that was one of the contributory reasons for the coup and the assassination of the Muslim premier. So we escaped, and I reached Liverpool docks, and everything was absolutely fine. We arranged for all our stuff to be sent to the house we'd bought at Wheatley, and I were entitled to first class passage by train. The Muslims, right to the end, kept to the letter of the law. I was even paid all my accrued leave, which took me to the 17th of January. I got aboard the boat about 15th of August, got off the boat at Liverpool on bank holiday Monday at the end of August, and Monday for Monday, 18 weeks later, I managed a job, and my accrued leave pay was still being paid to me monthly up to the middle of January. So I find it extraordinary. And even my savings in the Nigerian bank were transferred to a bank in Jersey for a very small bribe. So things were really quite reasonable for a time. But the next morning, I put on my best suit. For the last previous three leaves, I'd been able to afford a Savile Row suit, and put on my best one, and went down to an address given me to see the resettlement officer. It was a big, all chromium plate glass building near Victoria Station. And I went up to a sort of commissioner type who had a kind of semi-uniform and sergeant stripes. And I said, Aitchison, Nigeria. And he called out somebody at the reception desk, "Here's another, Bert." So I went up and I waited with lots of other people. And finally, I got into the office of a harassed-looking chap